Today we're back with my favorite person, legal genius Jessa Nicholson Getz from the podcast Getting Off, which I'm sure you are all listening to. And we're doing what I'm calling a sort of wind down of season three. Hi, Jessa.
Hey, Chelsea. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you for coming back and for making the time and on short notice and being such a champ. Did you listen to the final episode?
I did. Okay. And I was very happy with myself because I was a little bit behind. So I got to listen to Dr. Stowe's testimony and then the verdict episode back to back.
And was that good?
It really made for a compelling like crescendo to the season for me.
Oh, great.
To have it go from one end to the other. Yeah. And so I was like, oh, this was, you know, I really liked having more than one to go to, which I usually yours is one of the podcasts that I listen to immediately once it posts. But I had been tied up with things last week and didn't get to it. So I was enjoying that.
I fully
this week that I got to.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. I love binging things in general, sometimes more than waiting. There's something very satisfying about a binge.
I feel like sometimes you realize that the TV shows that you watch in binge form are not actually so good if you have to watch them week by week.
Right. Well, the problem with me, especially in between seasons, I sometimes like forget a lot of what's gone on in the show.
Yes.
I don't have the world's best memory. So binging is helpful to me just from an understanding perspective and like content absorption. So following my season finale, how did you feel? Did you feel mad or okay or bummed out or happy?
So, all right, let me start by saying this.
Okay.
This was obviously very compellingly written. Because my lawyer brain was completely fighting with my person brain.
Thank you for saying that.
And usually I'm pretty good at just staying focused in burden of proof. You know, I usually don't have any issues with that. Mm-hmm. And this, so I guess let me just give you some thoughts and take this for what it's worth.
Okay.
First of all, and this is a lawyer brain aspect of it. Oh my God, would I never have put that guy on the witness stand?
Really?
Oh.
I thought
it was such.
Okay, tell me why. Because I thought you'd be pissed off because I thought that some things came out on direct that didn't need to come out, and I was like, oh. And I'm thinking about you while I'm writing. I'm like, this. I think Jess is going to be annoyed that this is coming out on direct. But like, why wouldn't you have put him on the stand?
I actually think, and this is what I thought was so compelling about it, is he is exactly the type of defendant that would probably insist on taking the stand.
Oh, I see.
You know, like highly educated guy, successful guy, doctor, used to being in control, probably has some level of charm about him. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's the guy that thinks he's going to be able to get up and tell a story and that people are going to believe him because I think he's probably spent his life being believed.
Right.
And so as the hypothetical defense attorney in that situation, I am willing to bet that that type of client, that that client would not be interested in waiving his right to testify. And he came off as so creepy to me, both condescending and creepy. And that's exactly why I would have advised such a client not to testify. Mm-hmm. Because I had a really negative visceral reaction to him. And I had already, like, it's not as though listening to his, you know, if you want to call it avant-garde treatment, I guess you can. I think it's fake. I think this good father thing is not therapeutically sound. I'm a lay person, so whatever. You know, I'm no expert in that area, but it's not something that I would raise some eyebrows at that.
Right.
But it was so much worse hearing him describe it. And like just a million, like his, oh, yeah, well, I've bought her slips to go under dresses, but those aren't really undergarments. Like, dude, you're splitting hairs in a way that is not credible. Mm. And I don't know that I would have gone quite as far as Harriet did with regard to saying he admitted to evidence tampering, but he kind of admitted to evidence tampering.
Yeah, she really dialed in on that point, and I didn't think he admitted to evidence, you know, I don't remember, that wasn't my takeaway from his testimony, but did he?
Well, I think I, like, her point about him trying to control the narrative, I thought she took it further than I would have, but I did think that that reflected poorly on him. The other thing that was really difficult for me was the amount of time, you know, his answer of, well, I didn't call the police because she was already obviously dead. I didn't call an ambulance because she was already obviously dead. What was going to happen? And then he, you know, later says that he instructed somebody to check her vitals, and that was really inconsistent with me. And also just, you know, the idea that you're sitting there having a drink with this dead body for 2.5 hours or 3 hours, whatever it was, is he just didn't have a really good explanation for that. And I don't know that you needed one legally, but once he's up there and talking about it, it makes you as the listener want one, you know?
Right.
So if he had never testified, because what did he have to add? Well, okay, I didn't kill her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we all kind of figure you're saying you didn't kill her because you pled not guilty. I don't, you know, you just come off as totally, totally creepy. I mean, such a bad therapist. Such a bad therapist.
Right. I think he would have felt compelled to testify just so he could explain, like, look, I was not sleeping with her. Like, put that on the record. In fact, like, even though she right. might have been tempting me, like, I did not. Good on me. And, yeah, no, of course I didn't call the police, like, the ambulance right away. Why would I? Like, I feel like he probably, watching the trial, would have had all of these very, these reactions in which he thought he could, it just had an answer for everything. Just wanted to, like, lay it all out there.
Exactly.
Right.
Which I think is totally consistent with his personality and his career trajectory, you know, I can totally see that. So I thought that was very realistic, but at the same time, I thought he was a terrible witness.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like, listening to him, you know, listening to him made me move further towards some type of guilt than I was before that. But then that brings me to what I think is the interesting legal point here, or one of the many interesting legal points, but a big one for me, one of the primary reactions I had, was there absolutely is a charge that this guy was, in my opinion, guilty of, which is reckless homicide. And we call those Len Bias homicides. But when you deliver a drug to another person and they overdose, you are guilty of reckless homicide.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know if that's I don't know if it's on the books in Florida, but, you know, one of the jurors said, well, the prosecution just didn't prove their case. They didn't do a particularly good job. My response to that was, yeah, where they really dropped the ball was the charging decision, because there are different things you could have charged this guy with that I think would have been a lot easier to obtain a conviction.
Right.
I think murder was probably an over, you know, overreach. An overcharge. But if they had had the option of a reckless homicide charge or a negligent homicide charge, I think he was guilty of both of those things.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. So, from the writer's perspective, in season one, I felt like, you know, there were all these lesser included charges ranging from, you know, first degree murder down to, you know, manslaughter, and then you could be not guilty. Like, there were a lot of options, and they were trying to, and there were two, like, really polarizing sides in that deliberations room. And I felt like everyone kind of landed on manslaughter, possibly because it was the right charge, but also it was like the way in which they found compromise. And I reflected on that after the season ended and wondered, I wonder if I shouldn't have included that charge and then really forced them to make that hard decision. And would that have been more compelling just from an entertainment standpoint, or just to see, like, you know, where, you know, if the compromise is on the table, I think it would be easier for them to reach for that. And so this season, I was like, I really want them to, you know, commit to either first degree murder, which was the narrative that the state was alleging, like he premeditated this and tampered with her enema, and or not guilty. But you're right. I think that he probably would have been found guilty on one of those charges just for overprescribing. And there's a chance, and I don't know. So disclaimer, I don't know Dr. Ralph Greenson, and he was a real person. I certainly don't want to expose myself to any legal action. So I don't know this with any certainty, but I think maybe there's a chance that happened. Like, he panicked in the immediate hours following Marilyn Monroe's death because he was worried he would be found guilty for overprescribing. Like, if those were his drugs in her system, you know, and there were a lot. Like, she was a habitual barbiturate user, and he was the one who was writing those prescriptions. So I wonder if some of the weird cover up and the weird behaviors that happened immediately following her death were that because of that. I don't know. Just food for thought.
No, I can absolutely see that. And, you know, it's interesting because in real life, so in my state, when you have a first degree intentional homicide charge, you can, either side can ask for lesser included offenses. And there's always the exact tension that you're talking about. You know, you're talking about it from a writer's perspective and from an entertainment perspective. But from a lawyer's perspective, it's often a struggle to decide if you're going to ask for a lesser included, because you do fear that a jury will just grab onto one of the lessers as a compromise position. Right. And there are cases where that would be a win, but then there are cases where you really think your client's not guilty, and you don't want to offer that middle ground, because they might just say, yeah, well, let's do that. That way, you know, we're giving him a break. Even if a manslaughter conviction is still going to meet a, you know, 15-year prison sentence or whatever, they think it's a break because it's not the homicide conviction. And the prosecution, I think, worries about the same thing when making charging decisions, that they, you know, I mean, and Casey Anthony is actually a really good example of that, that they decided to go for the death penalty. And I think that in one way, kind of because there was an overreach on the front end, and they elected to really commit to that narrative, that you run the risk of an acquittal when if you run things all the way down. Although I think there were some lesser includeds for her, but the initial charging decision is what I'm talking about.
Right. I mean, I think the one thing she was found guilty of was lying to police, and she got, you know, time served.
Yeah, and I think there was like a child abuse charge. But, you know, I mean, that initial decision of, okay, what narrative are we going to go with? Are we going to leave room for this compromise, or are we going to swing for the fences? That's a strategic call on both sides. And it's not always an easy one, because you know, there are situations where you go, God, I don't want them to end up in the middle. Mm-hmm. And both sides could feel that way.
Right.
So I can understand the logic of that as a lawyer, and I certainly understand, and I agree with you. I think it was compelling to listen to them try and grapple with this sort of all or nothing. And that, of course, is where the conversation about nullification comes in, which was another very interesting part of this season to me.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm really interested in jury nullification, because my understanding of it, correct me if I'm wrong in any way, but jury nullification is when a jury decides, even though the law is compelling them to vote one way, they're going to vote another way, just because they feel like that's like the morally righteous thing to do. And they it is technically illegal, but you can't ever hold someone accountable for jury nullification because deliberations are sealed. And that happens. I think sometimes people find defendants, for example, like so unlikable, or they found the, or the, I read a book about murder cases in Texas, and like really old murder cases, when a lot of the times the circumstances would be such that a man would come home and find another man in bed with his wife, and so he would shoot him, and then that would go to trial, yeah. And he'd be like obviously guilty, but the jury would acquit him because they felt like, well, he had a right to shoot that guy in the face. So, there was a lot of examples of jury nullification in Texas that I read through and thought were interesting. So I like touching on that this season. What were your thoughts about it?
Well, so, you know, first of all, let me correct at least the way that the law works in our state, you know, in Wisconsin. And I don't know, it may vary from state to state. It's not illegal for the jury to nullify. It's impermissible for the lawyers to ask them to.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So nullification is a right that belongs to the jury, not the defendant, which is sort of weird. Juries are the fact finders, and they're the voice for the community. And so they can elect to, they are instructed to follow the law, obviously. But even within the confines of being instructed to follow the law, there are some really careful little turns of phrase in our jury instructions, because it's only been within the past century or so that we've moved away from being really supportive of jury nullification. Mm-hmm. That's a relatively new phenomenon. We, you know, back in colonial times and right after, you know, the Constitutional Convention and all of that, well into post-Civil War era, nullification was regularly argued and relied upon. And then that sort of fell out of favor, and it fell out of favor during the middle of the 20th century. But so in Wisconsin, for example, our jury instruction about reasonable doubt and the burden of proof reads as follows, and I'm quoting or paraphrasing, but it says, if you conclude that the state has not met their burden by proving every element of this crime, you must find the defendant not guilty. Mm-hmm. And then it says, if you conclude that the state has met every element, has proven every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, you may find the defendant guilty.
Okay.
So there's, you know, and that's subtle, but it's a difference, because the instruction is, if they didn't prove it, you must acquit. But if they did prove it, you may convict.
Yes. That's huge. Okay. All right. So I understand.
And so that's the line, you know, and so I'll give you an example, because the place that we're seeing more and more nullification, you've got to kind of thread that needle, right, if you're going to argue nullification. And with marijuana becoming legal in more and more states, the states that it's not legal in, there are a lot of people that are looking around and going, well, this is stupid. What are we doing here? And I live in a really liberal county. When it comes to drug policy, we typically don't charge small amounts of marijuana possession. I could go on a total sidebar tangent about what decisions might influence a prosecutor to do that despite our general non-prosecution policy. But we'll have jury trials about possession of marijuana or possession with intent to deliver marijuana, where the whole thing is really saying, you know, nobody's ever going to ask you why you voted the way you did. You don't have to answer any questions about this. You may find him guilty. You may decide no crime was committed here.
Right.
And that's, you can't, as a lawyer, you can't stand up and say, ignore the law and do what your heart tells you. But you can play with the language of the instructions to get there. And it's just sort of a subtle thread. But this were, I mean, your jury was talking about the opposite. They weren't talking about acquitting somebody that they thought was absolutely guilty. They were talking about potentially convicting him, even though they weren't sure the burden of proof had been met.
Right. Right. They felt, and the actors talked about this a bit on a break, is they felt like, you know, they thought that what he had done was wrong. And therapeutically speaking, with his practice with Ava, that he was in the wrong, and he was morally responsible for her death, but that the state didn't prove their narrative and the reasonable doubt existed in terms of the charge. And so, but they wanted to send a message, potentially. They were open to discussing sending a message that, like, this kind of reckless therapy is not okay, and the way to do that would be to find him guilty and affect, you know, change. Is that the way it came across to you as a listener?
Yeah, it did. That they were, you know, I mean, I really understood it to be like, and I thought that was interesting, the conversation that happened with, well, we could really send a message here that, you know, this is not going to be tolerated. And then there was this really great back and forth where it was like, well, wait a minute, there, you know, we punished people. We've convicted doctors for doing screwed up stuff for years. Like, look at what we did to everybody after World War II. Michael Jackson's doctor was convicted for overprescribing. You know, it really wouldn't be this novel thing to hold a doctor responsible. And I found that to be a really engaging aspect of the case. And it's one of the parts that I found myself, like I said to you at the beginning of this, where like lawyer brain and person brain were really conflicted, because there was a part of me that was like, yeah, this guy's a shitbag. Like, I don't believe anything. Number one, I totally think he was sleeping with her. I don't believe him. I did not find that credible. I don't find it credible that you would ever, as a professional, stay in the room while your patient undresses to try and show her that you're not sexually interested in her. Like, all of that was just simply not credible. Mm-hmm. And it made me dislike him so much.
Right.
And it was so obvious to me, at least. It felt obvious to me. And obviously reasonable minds can disagree about this, but it felt so obvious to me that this guy was harming her. Both in the, you know, I mean, he knew that she had other doctors that were prescribing her pills, and he's still prescribing these enema barbiturates. I mean, he knew about the fragility of her mental state and chose to introduce, really, in the best possible light, radical or avant-garde techniques in what I think is the most reasonable light is bullshit techniques. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, there, to me, I understand why there was outrage by the members of the jury that wanted to find him guilty, because I wanted to see him be held responsible for that, that in the most positive light, even if you assume this guy had every good intention with her, which I think is giving him a lot of credit considering the threat of the malpractice suit and, you know, all of that. But even if you assume that he did this with the best of intentions, we've still gotten to a point where your therapeutic boundaries are so shattered that this relationship is not doing anything positive for your patient. You know, in the most generous of ways, maybe you could say that he was just in too deep to really objectively see that. You know, when we, all of us at my office, have cases that really tug at our heartstrings, you know, where you realize that, oh God, I've really become attached to this client. I really care what's going to happen. And one of the things that I look to my partners to do and that I do for them is to say, you know, I know you're going to go in and make this sentencing argument for probation, but can we talk about whether or not that's a realistic thing or if that's just what you feel because you've come to care about this person? Because I don't have that relationship with your client, Nick. I'm hearing you and I'm saying this is not a probation case and you're saying it is. And I think it's because you've spent 200 hours with him and you like him. And that goes both ways. I mean, Nick has had to have that conversation with me plenty of times too.
Right. I mean, emotion must, you know, cloud perspective at times when you're dealing with just real people and those really intense, like, scary scenarios for them. I mean, how could you not be affected?
You know, and so I can understand how a really well-intentioned professional could keep moving the boundary line a little bit, because they feel like this is a person who just needs extra attention, until then they've just lost all objectivity. So I can see how that happens. Now, I think this guy had more sinister motives than that. But even in the best case scenario, I still think it was a hugely problematic relationship.
I agree. I think he had a God complex. He seemed to really just, you know, giving him credit for wanting to do right by Ava. He felt like he had the keys to this, you know, experimental treatment, and he was going to, like, you know, break the rules, but, like, save her. And there was this, like, damsel rescuer thing at play between them. And I think he just always found his judgment to be sound no matter what, even if you can't understand why. You just have to trust the fact that he knew what he was doing and that it was on the level.
Right.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. You know, and just I think that there was a very real control aspect there too, no matter how it developed, because I don't know anyone whose therapist is involved in their business negotiations.
Right. I don't either.
Like, how bizarre.
Right. I mean,
I can't even imagine a situation in which that would have been a possibility for people. Oh, I don't know. Just check with my therapist. What? Like,
right.
It's a contract.
Yeah. Even post-mortem, like, he was the one, like, the real Dr. Greenson, he told the police that he waited so long to call the authorities because he had to get permission from the Fox's studio publicity department. So even after she died, he was, supposedly, according to him, involved with her professional contacts. So it's just very, very odd. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that just seems so outside the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when you kind of updated this story and fictionalized it for today's purposes, I mean, maybe 50 years ago, some of this would have been more acceptable experimental treatment. But I feel like the state of psychology in the 21st century, everybody would look at this and go, ooh, no.
Right.
This is bad.
Right. Like, the ethics are so well defined now in any type of medical practice that it'd be hard to get away with these types of experimental treatments now.
You know, I will say this. I felt like I knew it was going to have to be not guilty. Number one, because they struggled so much with the medical testimony. And that was an interesting psychological process, I thought, to hear them talk through. Well, because it was kind of a wash, we just have to discard it. And that language with this jury of, okay, well, then we need to set that aside. I thought that was really interesting to listen to. And that makes sense, you know, because they're supposed to figure out what do we find credible and what don't we. But I did feel like the medical testimony having to be sort of tossed out, and the absolute commitment that Bill, the juror, had to this guy's innocence,
mm-hmm.
meant that there was no way going to come around to guilty. Like, I felt like Bill was way too strong of a personality to ever acquiesce to that.
Yeah, that makes sense. The medical testimony really did. It was just too... They didn't understand which expert to trust over another, and I think it was just overall too complicated for them. I mean, so did you, as a lawyer listening, did you agree with their decision to discard that evidence and discount it when deliberating?
So... kind of, mm-hmm. I guess. Like, yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the one hand, I think that there's a fault of the lawyers if at the end of expert testimony, the jury doesn't have a good foundation to decide who's more credible. Like, I think the lawyers can do things to work with experts to present testimony to help make it legible to lay people. And I didn't like the language of, okay, well, we'll just discard it, because that made it seem like they were erasing it. But I think that that was a semantic thing. You know, I think really what they were saying was, we can't draw any conclusions from this. Mm-hmm. And to that end, I fully accept that. And I think that that's a pretty logical conclusion when you have dueling experts.
Right.
You know, I mean, unless one, and this was, you wrote this very well, in that there was not one expert who was a total hack for one side or the other. You know, like there's a woman, there's a psychologist that testifies all over the country, but is based here in Wisconsin. And she has never testified for the defense in the 21st century. So she testified for one defendant once sometime in the 1990s and has never testified for the defense since. When I hear something like that, it's very easy for me to say, you know what, I'm going to discard that because you're not objective. Both of these experts were pretty objective experts. And so because they came to different conclusions, I totally get why the jury would say, well, we just have to look elsewhere.
Right.
That doesn't help us. I also think the struggle with circumstantial versus direct evidence was very realistically done and something that people really get tripped up on.
Right.
Because there's circumstantial evidence has gotten this really bad rap over time, where it's tossed out as like, oh, well, that's just circumstantial. That's just circumstantial. I would rather try a case with, like, if I were a prosecutor, I would rather try a case with strong circumstantial evidence than weak direct evidence any day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Because at a certain point, you get to the idea that the defendant must just be the unluckiest guy in the world.
Right.
That all of these circumstances just coincidentally line up to make him look guilty of something he didn't do.
Right.
You know, and so I, but at the same time, I understand when you're applying this very high burden of proof that you want something more than evidence that requires you to draw an inference. You want the answer to just be given to you.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think circumstantial does have a really bad rap. I mean, but people definitely get tripped up on it. I think possibly even in the Casey Anthony trial they did, because that was all circumstantial evidence, but it was a mountain of it, and they still couldn't find their way to convicting. And even after Rose read the jury instructions in season 3 in the final episode, which, by the way, were taken from the OJ jury instructions.
Ah, sure.
Even though she read the fact that they're allowed to contemplate or, you know, and take into consideration circumstantial evidence, and that it does have merit, et cetera, like there were still jurors after that that I heard kind of want to disregard it for being circumstantial.
Yeah. You know, I think it makes people uncomfortable, which I, you know, as a defense attorney, I'm glad to hear that, because I've had cases where I had one case in particular that was a sexual assault case that my client was like, look, yes, I was at this party, but I did not have sex with this woman. Please make them test the DNA. Please go get the DNA tested. It's going to come back, not me. She mis-ID'd me.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the prosecutor to go do the testing, and lo and behold, that was absolutely right. And by the way, the guy whose DNA it was looked nothing like the description she gave and looked nothing like my client.
Whoa. That's crazy.
You know, and eyewitness testimony theoretically is direct evidence, right?
Oh, I know. And that's now, I hope, commonly understood to be one of the most incorrect forms of identification.
Yeah, it's a terrible form of identification. It's completely unreliable, especially if you're talking about a cross-racial ID.
Mm-hmm.
Those are virtually worthless.
Right.
But and there's a lot of good social science data on it.
But for centuries, that was the key to the whole case. Right. It was. If you had someone see it, then, you know, conviction was in the bag. And now it's, today we understand that that is totally wrong.
You know, whereas like, if you and I are in a room together and everyone knows that only you and I are in the room, and then one of us walks out of the room and the other one's dead, there might not have been a videotape. Nobody might have been a witness to what happened, but circumstantially, odds are pretty good that one of the two people in the room that's still alive killed the other one.
Right. We can infer that safely.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not, but that is technically circumstantial evidence.
Right.
You know, you're the last person to see the person alive or whatever. And some of that is really powerful stuff. And I do. I think it gets a bad rap.
I agree.
The FabFitFun Fall Editor's Box is here, and it's so good. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box delivered 4 times a year with full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products for just $49.99 a box. These boxes are beautifully curated, and the value is amazing. Opening the box, you pull out one thing after another after another. I honestly use the majority of the things I received in my fall box every single day. My Cobra Bluetooth, my Skin & Co. Roma Shower Gel, my Do-It-All Eye Cream, my coffee pot. These are just such high-quality items that I get genuine daily use out of, and I'm so impressed with the collections they put together. Although you can customize the boxes yourself, I didn't, and everything was a total, complete surprise to me, and each one was more delightful than the last. The total retail value of the fall box is over $275. So you can really spoil your friends, family, or yourself with all of these goodies, but the only cost, $49.99 a box. And that's before the deliberations discount. So I don't know. To me, that value is unbeatable. And they make fantastic gifts. Like if you have a daughter in college or a friend who's a new mom, these are perfect. Sign up for FabFitFun today to get your Fall Editor's Box. The FabFitFun Fall Editor's Box is in limited supply, and these boxes always sell out. Use my code DELIBERATIONS to get $10 off your first box. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use promo code DELIBERATIONS to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com and use my code DELIBERATIONS to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
Let me ask you something about the lawyers. I noticed that one lawyer, the prosecutor, had sort of a calmer, more staid tone and way of presenting herself. And then the defense attorney was a little more emotional and a little, louder and more prone to making a quip or just like a bigger personality. And I was just wondering, in terms of the way lawyers present themselves, do you feel like they're one way is more compelling than the other in court?
I feel like the most compelling way to do your job in court is to be authentic with who you are outside of a courtroom. So, and let me just compare and contrast. And for a lot, we have a lot of listener overlap. So mm-hmm. My podcast, Getting Off, is with one of my two business partners, Nick Gansner. And Nick and I have very different courtroom styles. And that is in part because of our personalities. I'm kind of bombastic. I'm outspoken. I am excitable. I gesticulate wildly. I kind of operate as though I've always had 6 shots of espresso. and Nick is thoughtful and deliberate. And even when he's speaking very passionately, it's just a slower presentation. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a much more frenzied person than he is.
Right.
And that means that there are certain parts of my case that are very effective because of who I am. Like, if I want to do an aggressive cross-examination, the fact that I move at 100 miles an hour means that that witness does not have time to react in a way that will help them.
Right.
You know, so like that's a really strong part of my presentation. Nick, one of his strongest parts of his presentation are his opening statements, because he's able to just in this very matter of fact way say, no, look, I know that's what they say, but here's what's true. And here are the five ways you're going to know it's true. And that works for him because that's who he is. And what works for me because it's who I am. If I tried to walk into a jury and be folksy, I would get nowhere because no one would believe me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way I present. And, you know, there are prosecutors. It's not, in my experience at least, it's not about prosecution versus defense, though I do think generally speaking, defense attorneys are a little more flamboyant just because a lot of the time we're kind of using jazz hands to say, like, look at the shiny thing over here. So that requires a certain level of flair that maybe isn't required on the prosecution side. But I mean, some of my favorite prosecutors are incredibly aggressive personalities and sarcastic and loud and impassioned. And that works for them because it's authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my favorite defense attorneys to watch are professorial and measured, even though that's not how I am, you know, it's so I think that if you go too far with it, you can turn a jury off. But the reality is that no matter what your personality is, it's going to turn some juror off.
Right.
You know, like
you can't be everyone's cup of tea.
Right. You know, so there's a huge, like, Jerry Spence teaches this whole thing about being the most authentic version of yourself. And the joke that I regularly make is I need to go to a seminar that's the opposite of that. I need to be taught to be a less authentic version of myself because I don't know how to do it in any other way. But there's a lot of truth, you know, there's a lot of truth to that, that if that's your personality, I think letting it shine through is what's the most effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes total sense. I was just curious about your insights there. How would you have voted if you'd been on the jury?
I would have had to have acquitted him of the intentional homicide.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have very strongly shared the opinion that And again, people that listen to my podcast know I bang this drum constantly. I very strongly agree the prosecution did not do a good job here. Not the actual lawyering. Like, in the trial, I thought her presentation was just fine. The charging decision was what was driving me crazy, because I can see a very clear way to get this guy convicted.
Right.
So, but, you know, and this is to your credit as the writer, I can really understand why, when you've got such a high profile death, there would be public pressure to make a tough charging decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was realistic. You know, it's not like I didn't bump on it in terms of credibility of narrative. I just wanted her to make a different decision.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's very nice to hear. I think they made the right choice too, given what they had to work with. I haven't looked online, so I don't know what everyone else thinks, but hopefully, you know, I think everyone can pretty much understand why they reached the decision they reached. I mean, there just wasn't enough. There wasn't enough there. They weren't given the tools they needed to convict. I am a little surprised at how much everyone detested Dr. Stowe after his testimony. Like, I didn't want him to come off likable, but it was more than I expected. He really just rubbed everybody the wrong way.
Well, and kudos to the actor that played it, because I thought his delivery really contributed to that.
Right? He was great. His name is Joel Settles. He is an amazing actor. I'm very lucky to work with him. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because he was great. He was great. Also, your jurors were great, too.
Yes. Thank you. They were incredible. I loved working with them. They're so just passionate and invested and genuine, and it was a real pleasure just like sitting in this room. Well, sometimes it was horrible sitting in this room because I was invested too, and I got emotional too, and it's an interesting experience. But yeah, the cast, insanely good. Kudos to them.
Well, and I love your little like sort of preface where you're like, you know, we actually recorded this for longer than we intended to, and everybody really wanted to hang, and I kept telling them that they couldn't hang, and then finally I was like, oh, fuck it, just hang.
Yeah.
Which I had actually thought there was going to be, I knew there was no way it was going to be guilty because Bill's personality was just such that I didn't think that guy was ever going to move. So I really did wonder if it was going
to
hang.
So you thought that he would be less likely to move than Harriet?
I did.
Wow.
But that was because, and I say this with all due respect to Bill, I felt that Harriet at least would listen to the other side. I didn't feel like Bill really ever heard it.
Right.
You know, because,
yeah.
Yeah, and really, again, I guess like the episode of Stowe testifying really just changed the whole season for me, because I don't know that I would have said that until I heard his reaction to that, where he's like, yeah, okay, so he's not moral, but so what?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I'm like, wow, that was quick.
Yeah.
Like, you got over some pretty big moral failings pretty quickly, Bill. Like,
you bounced right back.
Yeah, that was fine.
Yeah.
He likes beer. Okay. He's always liked beer.
Do you like beer?
Do you like beer?
Do you?
What do you like?
Have you ever? Yeah. Yeah. He didn't budge. I think that he had enough support in the room too, that he felt like his back wasn't against the wall. And Harriet, it's funny. I thought that she was going to rub people the right way and like everyone, and sort of be like the champion, and Bill would sort of be like the villain that everyone kind of felt negatively towards this season. But a lot of stuff I've seen online, like Harriet did not rub everyone the right way.
I saw that. And you know what? I like her.
Yeah. I do
and
too.
I kind of, like, I've sort of stayed off the message boards because it's been interesting to me to read it. Like, I mean, I've read it, but I haven't commented. But that's been interesting to me because she didn't bother me at all.
Yeah. She did get, I think maybe people felt like she got too emotional and personal, but they really wanted to.
Well, it certainly was.
Yeah. Which is valid.
Quite emotional at the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
That really took me aback. So when we were recording it, they were going around and they were voting, and I thought they were going to finally reach an acquittal. And then she refused. And that's when we kind of like, all right, guys, you know, we broke. And I'm like, all right, just hang. Like, if we can't get there, we can't get there. And we all talked. And she said, no, Harriet will get there. I just need to find I need to find a way to do it in a way that makes sense for her, you know,
right.
And which was a really beautiful process to witness for, you know, in terms of this performance. And then she spoke and she delivered that really emotional decision at the end. And I was really affected listening to it. It was.
Yeah, I was too. And that was, you know, it was so, just another reason that I enjoyed listening to this so much, because a lot of the time the argument that I make, right, is you might not like everything about this person, but that doesn't mean that they're guilty of this crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, that's intellectual for me, but it was really enlightening to hear about how that must be very emotional for the jurors that have to make that decision, to understand that, like, yeah, okay, I hear what that lady's saying, and I get that that's what these instructions say, but I hate this guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was, I thought it was really well done. Did you enjoy doing the writing, drawing from a historical and historical fact pattern? Or
yes.
Because the first two seasons were totally made up out of whole cloth. Am I right? I mean,
right.
That's what I think. Yeah.
They were. And yeah, and this is the first time I based it on something real, and I loved it. I'm curious to know if listeners would be open to it again or not, or what they liked and what they didn't about it. Because for me, it was a lot of fun because I got to I love history, and I got to geek out over like all these old, you know, biographies and articles and insights, and like go down my own Maryland rabbit hole. And the whole thing was really, really fun for me to base it on just because I like learning about it. So actually, I was thinking about next season either doing a religion / cult story, kind of based Scientology-ish, and then, or doing something with like a kidnapper and a sort of like Stockholm syndrome, like Patty Hearst.
Ooh, like Patty Hearst.
Yes.
Both of those would be fun. You know, here, look, you had enough people get angry about your second season.
Yeah.
But if you really want to piss people off, let me suggest this. We had a series of trials, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago here, where it was, and I'm going to use my language, some weird fucking cult,
right.
Which they would tell you was just a blissful, peaceful religious sect. But it was, you know, they all lived on a compound, and there were instances of what any normal person, again, in my view, I clearly had an opinion about this, would have called horrific child abuse. Mm-hmm. And the defense was religious freedom. And one of my very dear friends was the prosecutor on those cases. And it was a very emotional thing for her. She, you know, she's not a particularly religious person, but that to her, she was like, you know, I'm here talking about crime or no crime, and they're over here talking about, well, but, you know, Jesus was going to fix it. She's like, I feel like we're having two totally separate conversations.
Right.
And I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And you see those cases in the news, right, where they're like, oh, the Jehovah's Witnesses kid died because he's not allowed to have the blood transfusion, or these parents just kept their kid home with the 104-degree fever because they figured they could pray and it would get better. What's your legal culpability there when your First Amendment right to exercise your religion causes the death of your child or substantial harm to your child?
Yes. Oh.
I think that's a very difficult issue. And I, you know, for those of us that are in like Camp Heathen, we all fall on one side, but people of faith probably have a different perspective than I do. And, you know, the First Amendment's an important thing too.
Right.
So where do you draw that line?
Oh,
but if you do a Patty Hearst, read Tubin's book. It was excellent. Jeffrey Tubin's book on Patty Hearst.
Oh, okay. I should. I've not read that
it's
yet,
really,
but I love that story. And you're right. That is a really interesting conversation. It's a really uncomfortable conversation. It'd probably be a great way to piss people off.
Yeah. Look, you've already done the sexual assault. Now try this.
Sex, religion, season 5
Fine.
Will be politics.
Yeah, next you can just like crib from the Reagan assassination attempt with Hinckley.
Oh, that would be fun. Oh, God. What's wrong with me?
Yeah, well,
that would be fun.
Well, listen, here I am. Here, Chelsea, write stories that everyone's going to hate.
It's great business advice. Thanks, Jessa.
Yeah, here. Let me think about the things that would let you alienate the most people. You should write about those.
Oh, my God. You're so fun. You're so fun to talk to and listen to.
Oh, thanks. And back at you.
Thank you. Do you have anything else that you wanted to bring up about season three before we wind down, finish winding down our wind down?
Well, I mean, here's just friendly advice for everybody. If your doctor tells you that he's going to be your father, get a new doctor.
Wiser words have never been spoken.
No, but
yeah, just shop around. At least shop around.
Just consider it. Just, you know, just check out alternatives. You never know.
You never know.
You never know. No, but I guess I would say this is that I'm glad that the, as much as I was not a fan of Dr. Stowe, I do agree with the verdict. And I do think that it's important that we don't convict people just because we think they're shitbags. And I really liked hearing that struggle play out. I thought that was really interesting. And I'm glad that it ended up the way that it did. Because obviously, even having somebody who seems like a shitty human being be falsely convicted is a devastating thing to the function of our justice system.
Right.
We don't want people to be wrongfully convicted, no matter what we might think of them. I would also say that I think that the wrongful death suit that our Dr. Stowe was facing in the CODA is totally going to end up against him. Yeah. I think that would be the biggest slam dunk of a civil trial since the OJ. Civil
trials. I agree. I don't see how he'd weasel his way out of that.
No, that one I think he's done with. And I was happy to hear that. See, I love how invested I get in this, where I'm like, I was really glad that you revoked his medical license. Yeah.
Thank you.
Because he is a real person with a real medical license took away. Right.
Glad he's not doing any more fictional damage out there.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for correcting that. That I was really glad you did that.
That means so much to me to hear that you care. Thank you for caring.
So how long are you on hiatus for until you start season four?
I don't know. I have to decide that immediately, though. I've actually passed my deadline for deciding and alerting Audio Boom as to my intentions. So bad on me. They're being very sweet with me about it. Nice. But I will announce that as soon as I can. And what are you able to announce or talk about in terms of getting off? What should be?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here we are. So getting off, we wander into our different tangents, and we spent the whole summer doing like the summer of terrible racial injustice in the American legal system. Mm-hmm. And that was a bummer. Like, I think that they were good episodes and I'm proud of them, but it was a downer. And we're about to go into what Nick and I are calling legal idiocy. It's going to be the fall of legal idiocy. So yes. What we're going to do is take cases that deal with people with fringe thinking ideas about what the law says and go into those. So our next deep dive is going to be into the world of incels and how they interpret the Constitution to justify the idea that women aren't people legally.
What?
And then, yeah. Oh yeah. This is a thing.
Incels. I don't know anything about this.
Oh, all right. So an incel is somebody who is that stands for involuntarily celibate.
Oh.
So it's this online, largely an online community. There was a Reddit sub forum until it got banned in 2017, and now it's reinvented itself. But the sort of, and this is going to be our first deep dive case in this area, but the first sort of public mass shooting that involved incels was Elliot Rodger out in California. And he wrote a 141-page manifesto about how the Declaration of, you know, like this is the theory. The Declaration of Independence says that all men are created equal, and it doesn't mention women, which means that women aren't really people.
Oh, and so
there is no such thing as rape because you'd have to harm a person, and women aren't people under our laws.
Wow.
So we're going to explain why that's total horseshit.
Oh my God.
And delve into that. And then we're going to do the Posse Comitatus sovereign citizen guys.
Okay. Yeah.
So we're going to have a fall of fringe legal groups and how their ideas play out on the national stage when there are trials.
Oh, that sounds so juicy.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to where we're going next. It's going to be fun.
Yes.
And everybody can find us. We are the Getting Off Podcast. And our social media stuff is all Getting Off Pod. There's an Instagram. There's a Facebook group. There's an Etsy shop. There's Twitter. And there's a Patreon, which if people are interested in really painfully, painfully in-depth coverage of everything that happened with Brett Kavanaugh, there are 5 Kavanaugh episodes up on Patreon. So
good.
So you can go join. So that's where we're headed.
I love that.
Our next
fall is going to be
legal
fun.
Legal idiocy.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to it. I think we're going to get to dissect a lot of common misconceptions or fringe misconceptions, but explain what causes people to start to believe these things in the first place.
Oh my God, I love it. This is going to be fascinating.
So
thank you for talking about that stuff in the near future. And thank you for joining me today to talk about my stuff. And as always, you are the greatest guest ever, and I feel very lucky. Thank you, Jessa.
This concludes season 3, unless I throw up any bonus episodes or try and get creative. If there's anything you guys want to hear, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at DeliberationPod, without an S, and on Facebook at DeliberationsPod. Most of the conversations happen inside my Facebook group, Deliberations Room. So please join and talk. I love every member. You're all so insightful and funny. As for season 4, as discussed, details pending. I'm not sure, so if you guys have any preferences, anything you'd like to explore, tell me. Please, I want to know what you think, what you like, what you want to hear. In the meantime, I will sign off, but I'll be back as soon as I can. And thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening this season. You guys and the fact that you're listening mean the world to me. So, thank you.